Hello, everyone. This is ARPA Canada. I'm Colin Posma talking with John Sycamore, legal counsel. So, John, last week we obviously had a big case that we were involved in. We had the opportunity, yourself and Joel, to be present for the intervention in the CHP court case, which was in Toronto. You had 15 minutes where you were able to sort of lay out our arguments to the court on kind of our reasoning behind why we considered this to be an issue. The issue at play was transit advertising in Hamilton. Why are we considering the issue of transit advertising so much? Like, we obviously have a couple of direct court cases that we're involved in. The ARPA is involved with the City of Hamilton, with the City of London, and we've been involved in a couple of cases like that. Why public advertising like this?
Yeah. So, I mean, part of it is that advertising with cities on city-owned property and transit systems in particular is just a good way to reach members of the public you might not otherwise reach. And it's constitutionally protected, right? Because it is owned by the government. So sometimes we have the challenge of, if you're trying to advertise on a sensitive political issue, that advertisers will just turn you down and you don't really have any recourse.
In terms of like a private advertiser, though.
That's right, yeah. A private advertiser. But when it comes to a transit system, right, our law developed such that the court decided, well, it is owned by the government. The government's creating a public forum. Initially, cities tried to argue that the charter shouldn't apply here because it's basically the government's operating like a private property owner. But the courts have said, no, you've created a public forum, the charter applies. And so in some way, it should be actually an easier forum for us to get our advertising into. But cities are typically progressive and often resist posting this kind of thing. In this case, right, an advertisement saying that women are by definition female. And we've had similar problems with whether it's pro-life ads or with our Let Kids Be campaign, right? Asking, calling on policymakers to put a stop to medical transition for minors. We've still encountered cities saying no to these kinds of ads.
And they'll often do it sort of abruptly, right? Like obviously in the case of the Let Kids Be advertising in Hamilton, we had it on it was technically a private billboard, if I understand correctly, in that situation. But the mayor came in and just said, well, it's a billboard that's on city land. And so we're going to take it down. Now, obviously we're involved in that whole situation, but So tell me a little bit more about, you had talked before we were starting about sort of the comparison between U.S. law and Canadian law in regards to this, and the distinction between the two, and in some ways that Canadian law seems to be more favorable to public advertising in that sense. Maybe talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So what I was mentioning about a public forum, right, that a government can create, this kind of comes to us from U.S. case law. It goes back, you know, many decades before Canada's, because we had a charter starting in 1982. But where Canada parted ways with the U.S. is, in the U.S., a government can create a public forum, such as transit advertising is a very good example, where they create a limited public forum. So in the States, they could say, you can have commercial advertising only on buses. And that's been upheld. Now, that's fairly narrow range of expression, but that's been upheld. So as long as in the States, it's a fair and precise and evenly enforced rules, right? Whether that's commercial advertising only, or it might say no promoting or opposing political candidates or parties. That might be another rule. So providing it's fair, the courts have said that's fine. Cities often get into trouble. You know, if there's evidence that they're not actually enforcing it fairly, then that can lead them into problems. In Canada, our seminal case is the 2009 Greater Vancouver Transit Authority case. And in that case, they had rules against advertisements, political advertisements that could, you know, cause controversy or offense. These aren't terribly well-defined rules, obviously, but that's not specifically why they were struck down. The court said limiting advertisement to, you know, non-political advertising doesn't seem to compromise the objective of having a transit system that is safe and welcoming for transit users. And so the courts struck down those rules and didn't go the direction of, well, as long as you have rules, even if they're fairly strict rules that are fairly enforced, you're fine. They said, we don't want to see those kinds of rules unless you can justify them in terms of keeping the transit system safe. So Canada, from that case, you'd say, oh, there's actually a more generous constitutional protection for transit advertising. But what we end up having is, in Canada, there's a remark in the case, the Greater Vancouver case, where the court says, you know, it's not that an advertisement is controversial or political that would undermine the objective of having a safe and welcoming transit system, but it might be that an ad promotes violence or that the ad is discriminatory, and just kind of leaves it at that, right? Without saying a whole lot more. And this is kind of where the city of Hamilton and other cities have picked up on this and said, well, if an ad's discriminatory, it's kind of side comment by the court, that might be a reason it undermines a safe transit system. And so we get into what is discriminatory. And ARPA's key argument was, well, there's ways in law to tell whether something is discriminatory. There should be a high bar for that. Keep in mind, this is a free speech case where the Supreme Court was striking down rules on transit advertising. But cities have been able to come in and basically say things that are conservative, especially socially conservative, are discriminatory. And you end up with clearly a politically and ideologically biased enforcement of these advertising rules that cities now have that would not be permissible in the states.
So in the states, is this a regional, like, is this also, because in Canada, obviously the charter applies across the board. Is that the same in the states, or is it sort of region by region, you can have different advertising policies?
Yeah, it's a good question. So two things. So first, the First Amendment is what applies. That goes all the way back to, you know, the Bill of Rights in the early 1800s. And that would apply across the country. But given the legal test that I just mentioned, where the government creates what they call a limited public forum, you do have variations, right? So one town might allow any advertising short of, you know, something that, you know, advocates violence or is obscene or something like that. And another town might have only commercial advertising is allowed. And both of those are justified. They wouldn't be in Canada, sure, right?
So then how does that work in Canada? So, and what year, just to clarify, what year was the Greater Vancouver?
2009.
And that sort of has become the, just saying back to you what you said, that has kind of become the case that everybody's referring back to in terms of transit advertising.
That's right.
As the, okay. And so the issue at hand there then was, or the resolution of that was, as you mentioned, the key things being safe and welcoming. Right. And so, I mean, we heard that in the court last week as well, that seemed to be the common comment. But is there anything else that a city could do? Like, are there other parameters that they could place on their advertising and say, we only allow this kind of, like what you were saying, in the states? Or is it, you know, across the board, doesn't matter what city you're in, the standards are the same? How does that work?
Yeah. So there's another requirement in our constitutional law that, as a section one of the charter, that a limit on a fundamental freedom or a right be prescribed by law. So the Supreme Court isn't, you know, giving the legal prescriptions on how to do that in the Greater Vancouver case. But it says, it actually mentions, well, some cities use the Canadian Code of Advertising Standards. It's created by a private body, but it can be incorporated into municipal policy as law effectively. And that's what a lot of cities have done, is to say, okay, we'll follow the Canadian Code of Advertising Standards, which, as it happens, it's largely about consumer protection. It's largely, you know, created by and for commercial advertisers to not mislead, deceive consumers. And interestingly, it has actually an exception for political advertising. So, you know, ads may not mislead people. We're not going to decide whether a political ad misleads people, right? Mm-hmm. So beyond that, because this was clearly in the CHP's case, a political ad, they will say, we won't allow ads that violate the Human Rights Code or the Criminal Code. And that should be setting a fairly low bar. So, you know, ads that amount to hate speech, ads that are obscene, ads that promote hatred or violence, or when it comes to the Human Rights Code, right? The Human Rights Code is designed to ensure people have equal access to housing, jobs, services. So how would an advertisement violate that? There is a provision in the Human Rights Code that says you may not advertise an intent to discriminate. Right, so an example would be you're advertising housing, but only for not for people of a certain race. Well, that would, right, you're clearly advertising an intent to discriminate, or that tries to incite others to discriminate, and actually says very specifically in the Human Rights Code that's inciting others to discriminate contrary to the Human Rights Code. So you're encouraging others to not grant housing to, you know, ethnic or religious group X. Right, so that would be violating the Human Rights Code in an advertisement. So the city should be able to point to, well, we think that we don't have to wait for you to get convicted or fined under the Human Rights Code. We have a reasonable basis to believe that could run afoul of these areas of law. We're not going to accept that advertisement. But again, when it comes to the Human Rights Code, cities have taken liberties to say this seems to go against the spirit of the Human Rights Code, the values of the Human Rights Code, and for that reason, we won't allow it. And that opens up some very difficult territory for us to navigate, because it seems like courts are quite sympathetic to this human rights values type of argument.
Mm-hmm. So that gets into a whole other area. But before we get there, so just clarifying then, the ad standards that you were talking about is sort of a grouping of private organizations together that sort of have agreed to a particular type of set of standards, right?
That's right.
So the cities are taking that and adopting it, not because they have to, but because it's just an easier way of them applying a set of standards to this. But I guess the distinction there, so just pointing out then the distinction between the private public is the private companies can do whatever they want, right? If you have a sign up somewhere that you own personally, you can kind of accept or not accept whatever advertising you want, right? If you have a truck trailer on the side of a road somewhere, you can put up pro-life advertising on it, and as long as it's on private land, nobody can do anything, unless there's other bylaws right. that apply to that, right?
If you're selling advertising, right, and you say, well, this looks like a Muslim advertisement, we won't accept it, we will accept the Jewish advertisement, well, you know, that's a human rights code issue as well, because you're selling a service, which is advertising, and the human rights code will apply to that. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, the charter doesn't apply. If it's your own, like if you own a field and you have a billboard on it and you're putting your own signs on it and you're not selling advertising to the general public, then yeah, no such rule would apply.
Okay. So the bar is higher then for the cities in that context, because the charter then applies to them, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So moving then to that comment you made about the values, because it seems to me in observing court cases over the last number of years that's it's coming into this conversation about the Constitution. You get this is the Constitution something that's solid that kind of stays the way it is, or is it this there's these living tree comments, or does it change over time? Does it kind of is it shaped by the values of the culture that we're in now? Right? Maybe comment on that first in terms of, you know, audit to do that, and how much does that impact the way judges are now ruling in some of these cases in terms of values-based judgments, and, you know, so the way they're ruling now might be different than they would have 10 years ago or something like that.
Yeah, so on the one hand, you have the jurisprudence, the case law on free speech, and we continue to see strong endorsements of, strong defenses of free speech by the Supreme Court and the courts of appeal on that side of it, right? So it seems like they say they recognize this continues to be the lifeblood of democracy. Being able to express yourself is related to your own personal dignity. The purposes of, you know, pursuing truth and political participation, these things are all still true. They're all still important. Where we start to get into trouble is, of course, what are justified limits on expression? No one, even the most, you know, ardent libertarian, doesn't believe that freedom of expression has no limits. And so where things start to get messy in our law is this kind of enabling of again, I talked about human rights values, charter values to balance it out. So you might say we have freedom of expression on the one hand, and that's a constitutional value. You'd say actually it's a constitutional right, right, against the government. But on the other hand, there's the constitutional value of equality. And legal conservatives have always been keen to say, well, again, you can't just take values in the abstract. One doesn't have a quality right against a political party to be recognized as their preferred gender identity. You have no such legal right. But they will try to balance the scales by saying, well, we're drawing freedom of expression on the one hand, equality on the other hand. They're both constitutional values, and so it's easier to kind of cancel out freedom of expression. And this is what we're certainly seeing more of at all levels, from especially at human rights tribunals, but all the way into higher courts recently as well.
More and more limiting of freedom of expression because of those things.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So moving then to the case, obviously, that took place last week, the Christian Heritage Party case. They had an ad on city buses, presumably, or
they
bus
tried
shelters.
To. Bus
oh, they
shelters,
were trying
yeah.
to. Okay. Maybe talk a little bit about what that ad was and what happened in that case.
Sure. So they had a picture of a woman on a poster that said woman, colon, adult female, and then Christian Heritage Party. I think it said something like standing for truth and justice, or bringing truth and justice to Canadian politics. And then, you know, the name of the party website. So it was very clear.
Pretty simple.
Yeah. And very clear too, that it's like, this is, I think people generally understand this when they see an ad on a bus shelter, that it's not, you know, thus says the city, it's not the city speaking to you. It's the car dealer or whoever had the CHP party name and party website on there. So clearly this is a political party sharing with you its position, its stance on this issue. And the city wouldn't allow that particular ad.
Okay. So then, so that means that like it didn't go up at all.
It didn't.
So, yeah. Okay. So the case at hand was then the CHP took the city to court saying this wasn't a proper application of the charter. This was, you know, them deciding to shut down political advertising. Talk a little bit about kind of what their arguments were.
Yeah. So there was back and forth between the CHP and the city for months. First, the city said through its it had a private sector agent, but anyway, they said we can't run this; it goes against the code of advertising standards. They didn't really give much further explanation. Later, they kind of abandoned the code of advertising standards, which I mentioned has a kind of a general exception for political ads, and then they end up sending a 4-page letter. And the letter waffles quite a bit. It says, "Look, people are going to see this ad as exclusionary, as offensive, as upsetting, but the city acknowledges we can't censor it on that basis alone." Okay, so why did you spend half a page on that? We're not sure. Then it goes into, you know, the city has policies, internal policies for employees, but also to guide service provision. They touch on, for example, how the city is going to have deal with washrooms and that kind of thing. And the city takes the position, as does Ontario law, that someone who identifies as a woman is a woman. So woman is based on subjective gender identity, not based on sex. And your ad is not in line with that. But we acknowledge that just because your position just is at odds with the city's position on a political issue, we can't censor on that basis either. So again, it's okay. You've spent another page or so, but it seems to conclude with saying,
you're kind of trying to say, you know, we're having a really hard time here. Can you please help us out? Like, we don't really want to.
These are reasons we don't like the ad, yeah. But we're not claiming this to be the reason that we're rejecting it. And then the last couple pages of the letter, they get into what seems to be trying to create an evidentiary basis for rejecting the ad, but they never really connect the dots to say, okay, so they get into, we saw a study that studies negative media depictions of transgender persons. So an example of that would be a character in a show who's transgender and is presented as, you know, sexually predacious, or media reporters consistently misgendering someone in an interview. And then we ask people who identify as transgender the impact of that on their mental health. And we find that it has a major negative mental health impact. And so there, this, you know, negative media depictions harm transgender persons' mental health. They don't go on to explain how is this ad, which doesn't mention transgender people. I mean, it's indirectly related, of course, to gender identity and so on, but it doesn't depict a transgender person or claim to. They just leave it at that. Then they say, you know, Hamilton police data show that reported hate incidents, that doesn't necessarily mean a hate crime, but incidents that are reported to police that are
somebody's, or gender identity is, about,
right, is suspected to be right. A factor have gone up in the last few years. So again, okay, and you know, is asserting that women are by definition female in a public forum, is there any evidence that would increase hate incidents? Do you think people, by virtue of believing that women are female, are more likely to engage in a hate crime? There's no further explanation given. And so this is they just kind of leave it out there. And in the hearing, the city ends up backtracking a little bit and saying, well, we're not saying necessarily that this will incite hate crimes. We're just saying this is the relevant background against which our decision was made. So transgender people are suffering in some cases in awful ways, like by being the victims of crime, that maybe gender identity seems to be a factor in those crimes. And in light of that context, we think it's more easy to justify a decision. But again, this kind of logical connecting of the dots from the ad to the crime prevention is
you
simply
sort of
not
ideologically
done.
Follow them through it for all the dots to properly connect.
Right.
Yeah. So this was at a lower court. Maybe talk a little bit about how does that work its way through the system now? Because obviously that was the first stage. The city of Hamilton won at that first stage, right?
Yeah. So the city of Hamilton won at the divisional court, which is a like the Court of Appeal, a 3-judge panel, and the city won 3-0 at that panel. And then the Christian Heritage Party appealed to the Ontario Court of Appeal. They had to get permission. So once it's promising that the Court of Appeal said, yes, we will hear the case, obviously they saw something was reviewable. The lower court decision is very short, in my opinion, pretty lacking in a substantive analysis of the main constitutional issues, which is perhaps another reason that the Court of Appeal took the case. But yeah, so the Court of Appeal hearing was just last week, and we have to await the Court of Appeal's judgment.
So at the Court of Appeal level then, so obviously that's sort of one level up from where the divisional court, the first stage of this hearing took place. What's different about the appeals court? Is there anything that they're, are they taking on new evidence? Are there different people involved? Like, what's different at that level? Or are they purely reviewing what's in the case already?
Yeah, so in this case, there's no new evidence. It's really just the Court of Appeal actually kind of steps into the shoes of the lower court. So it's not even really, strictly speaking, reviewing the lower court's decision and saying, here's where the lower court went wrong or not. It's stepping in and saying, we're going to review the city's decision and issue our ruling on whether it's reasonable. And really the only difference is this is a court of, you know, significantly more authority. It's binding on all the other courts in Ontario.
Okay. So does that, at the divisional level, it wouldn't do that? Like if their decision on the CHP case couldn't be used as precedent in other places?
It's essentially just redoing what the lower court did, but at a higher level of court.
Okay. Yeah. So at what stage do interveners get involved? Is that at the divisional court level, or is this the first stage at which interveners can have a part to play?
Their equality for gays and lesbians everywhere are pretty prominent and well-funded, including with taxpayer dollars. Progressive group was involved at the lower court. And then when it gets to the Court of Appeal, normally it draws more intervener attention because it's going to be a more important precedent. Yeah. And so there were several groups, five in total, that tried to intervene, three on the more pro free speech side and two on the other. And ultimately one from each side was let in. So EGAL and ARPA.
Okay. So what, talk a little bit about that. How do we apply? How did we get in? What were the sorts of arguments the court thought, hey, this is a unique, assuming that's the way they're doing this, is here's a unique perspective on this. This is going to impact more people. Why ARPA?
So I think the Christian Heritage Party, they have at the Court of Appeal level, you have a 30-page strict factum limit. And there's, I think, enough significant issues in this case that more legal arguments would be useful for the court. And so looking at the CHP's argument, we thought there was room to argue, one, the merits of the message of the ad. So CHP had to argue, was it procedural fairness, right? What did the city actually deal with them fairly in a fair process? You know, they spoke to their LGBTQ advisory group without getting the CHP to interact with that advisory opinion. So there's a lot of questions about procedural fairness that took up a fair bit of space. We thought there was room for defending the merit of the ad, defending, you know, this isn't akin to hate speech. It's not discriminatory speech. It's actually an important public issue. Courts in other countries have recognized this. And so to defend the speech as not hateful, not discriminatory, but actually important for the purposes that we have for your freedom of expression in the Constitution, right? Pursuing truth, political participation, and even trying to promote and pursue sound policy. These debates should be happening in Canada. So we kind of picked up on that part of it. And especially, and this is really the focus at the hearing, the point about this ad does not violate, the city has not shown that it violates any city policy, any law, or any other objective legal standard.
Mm-hmm. So that's where the sort of values judgment is coming into this, where they're saying, like you said before, there might be potential harm. Because there's potential harm, we think it would be problematic to have an ad like this go up. And so it seems like, I mean, so I was sitting in the room, obviously, while this was happening, just listening in. You were able to have interaction with them for 15 minutes. But it seemed like the court was not interested to hear some of these arguments. And so that I found a little bit surprising, in the sense that if the bar is so high, why does it seem like maybe that bar is being lowered over time? Maybe there's, you know, the standards. I don't know. Maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think the court was struggling with, so there's a number of ways, again, that speech can be discriminatory. That's a potentially broad term. And I think the court was wrestling particularly with, take an employment scenario, right? Someone is talking critically about gender identity, you know, maybe saying transgender identities are, you know, or illogical or fantasies or whatever. And in a certain workplace for a transgender employee, that would be considered a hostile work environment. If the employer just does nothing about it and says, yeah, there's you know, to use the language of the day, transphobic comments being made, that could be a hostile work environment, right? And that could be a under employment law and under human rights laws, it applies to employment discrimination, right? So the court, I think, is drawing an analogy to, okay, well, in a transit system, if there's something that a transgender person is going to see as upsetting, is that kind of now a hostile or a poisoned transit environment? But there's not really a one-to-one comparison there. Because again, when it comes to speech in a public forum, the only kind of human rights provision that applies is this in communicating an intent to discriminate in a protected area, right? Such as, like I mentioned before, not providing housing to a certain group or something like that. So I think the court struggled there, or maybe the court thought that was a way to reach a certain outcome, would be to draw this analogy with a poisoned work environment. But where I think a point that did land, and that I think is very important, is another way that the city argued the ad was discriminatory is just that it's out of line with legal doctrine as it applies to gender identity. Right. And we've seen this before as ARPA when it comes to advertising, pro-life advertising, where our ad implies that a preborn child is a person and a human. And cities have come and said, well, the law says that they're not a person. And our response to that is simply, look, the criminal law in particular, but the law generally is deciding one thing, right? Will we afford property rights to preborn children? Will we provide legal protections against abortion to preborn children? And the law can get that wrong, but the law is not even claiming, right? And then the Supreme Court's noted this as well, to say that this is the truth, right, for society when it comes to this is what's going to be what limits debate. You're not allowed to say unborn children are persons because the criminal law doesn't recognize them as legal persons.
Well, how could you ever challenge law then, right? Of course. Isn't that the point of parliament is to question and wrestle with law and
exactly.
So that's the standard of truth. That's a little bit problematic, obviously.
Right. And so I think we were pretty keen to call the city out on this. There's passages in their factum where they say the ad is legally incorrect. The ad runs contrary to the law of this province, as if that is a sufficient basis to, at least when it comes to, you know, human rights law, that it's kind of you go against this doctrine. It almost treats human rights law and its position on gender identity as kind of a civic creed that you're not allowed to dissent from, kind of this almost punishing heresy versus, okay, we can't point to how you're discriminating in law, except that you don't agree with the underlying philosophical position of the law. And we say the underlying philosophical position of the law is subject to debate if this is a democracy, right? So I think that point landed. I hope the court doesn't kind of, you know, adopt any of the city's language or reasoning on that point, because that would be pretty devastating. Mm-hmm.
So what happens after this? Loss, win, what's the implications for this kind of speech?
Yeah. So obviously one concern we have is our Let Kids Be campaign. There's kind of an outstanding issue there. It wasn't on transit, but even, you know, a billboard by a highway, could the city justify restricting that? I think some of that will be that could be majorly impacted by this case, by this decision. There's a number I've talked about ways the city argued that this was discriminatory speech. One thing that EGAL did in the hearing that was I thought was pretty bold is we pointed the court to a legal test for, even if you can go beyond, you know, speech that says a service or benefit should be denied to a certain group, which the ad doesn't do. The courts have looked at limits based on whether a message promotes discriminatory treatment, and this is like, you know, kind of severe mistreatment of a group, and calls into question their basic humanity. So we of course argued that, you know, all people are male or female. Being male or female doesn't make you more or less human. Same with debates about gender identity. This does not make you more or less human. So the idea that it's questioning someone's very humanity, this is getting into, you know, hate speech territory, is not an issue here. And so again, that's another basis on which the city cannot rely to censor the ad. But EGAL stood up after us and said, basically ARPA has identified the right legal test. It's kind of this strict hate speech level test that the court has found, even like mocking someone with a disability in a certain context, the Supreme Court said that wasn't akin to this type of discriminatory or hate speech. EGAL basically stood up and said, ARPA has identified the right test, and this is hate speech on that basis. So if the court finds, and this is what the lower court basically did find is that this is kind of akin to hate speech. Denying someone's very identity almost calls into question their humanity by not recognizing their gender identity. And that, I think there's a risk the court picks up on that level, line of reasoning. And that would be pretty devastating for not just ARPA's advertising on some of its campaigns, but for the ongoing debate on the gender identity issue, which I think we're seeing signs that it's starting to turn. Maybe that's also why progressives and city governments are so adamant that this kind of advertising not be permitted, because there's kind of leaks in the dike, if you will, on this whole gender ideology.
Hmm. Does this apply to the rest of Canada? A hearing like this at this level, or how does that work?
So strictly speaking, the Ontario Court of Appeal decision will only be binding on all Ontario courts, but it's the highest court in the country's largest province. It certainly will have large persuasive appeal in other provinces. So if similar cases arise in other provinces, you can expect courts to cite and discuss this case, not necessarily follow it, but if they're not going to follow it, they'd give some explanation of why. So we did see that in the Trinity Western case, right? We saw the Court of Appeal in BC go one way, the right way. Mm-hmm. The Court of Appeal in Ontario go another way. The court in Nova Scotia another way. So in that case, actually, the Ontario Court of Appeal was in the minority at the appellate court level, even though the Supreme Court ultimately went the way of the Ontario Court of Appeal in siding against Trinity Western's law school. But that's how that would work.
So ultimately, it would have to go to the Supreme Court level before it would be binding on the rest of the country.
That's right. Okay.
I was sitting there too, there was one point at which I, like you said, during the EGAL presentation, that I thought, I wish we could record some of what was going on in the court. And I know you're not allowed to, but I just think some of the stuff that was being said and being accepted on face value as fact, I'm just not sure that's where Canadians are at. You know, that was my reaction anyway, was for them to be saying that just stating that a woman is an adult female is a hateful thing to say.
And there is no debate on it. That's what's striking too. We're in court on a free speech case. Yeah. And for the other side to be saying there is no debate. There should be no debate. I mean, this is partly why we cited cases from other countries, from appellate level courts in Britain and the U.S. saying this is an important public issue. Yeah. To try to signal to the court, you're going to look kind of silly if you say this isn't an important public issue.
That just struck me as somebody who hasn't been as into the details of some of this as quite shocking. And it made me think, what would it have been like if we had a women's rights group there as an intervener or something like that to say, okay, you're telling us that there is no distinction between a transgender female and a female, and that to say so and to argue that that's true, or even to have the debate is a hateful, hateful conversation to have. This is stepping into some dangerous territory, I think.
Yeah, and I think and I hope that if the case were to reach the Supreme Court, that you would see more groups coming forward, and hopefully a women's rights group, to use the term gender critical feminist group. And in an important UK case, we did see that. We saw the court citing Kathleen Stock and Holly Lawford Smith. These are important gender critical feminist scholars with whom we would agree pretty strongly on this issue. I think their kind of philosophical analysis of this is sound, and their concern for women's rights is being based on women are actually female. This is what gives rise to the term women and to women's rights and to unique concerns about their protections that are appropriate for women in society. And so I do hope, again, if the CHP loses, I hope they will appeal and be able to get leave to appeal to the Supreme Court, and that we'll see some additional strong interveners to join us there.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Thanks very much, John.
Thank you.